Fred Pearce calls water the defining crisis of the 21st century. Pearce is a leading contributor to New Scientist. He traveled the world researching his most recent book, When the Rivers Run Dry, Journeys into the Heart of the World's Water Crisis. Fred Pearce joined me in a conversation from London, England this week, and I began by asking him to explain a key concept from the book, that of virtual water. One of the most fascinating concepts that you write about is that of virtual water. Can you explain what that means?
Virtual water, yes. It's a strange term. It was coined by an academic in the UK called Tony Allen, who said, look, particularly in the Middle East, which is his speciality, countries have long since run out of water in the sense that they don't have enough water to grow the crops and particularly the food crops they need to live, as a result of which they import large amounts of food because they, as I say, they don't have enough water to grow it themselves. So they're effectively importing water in those crops, or they're, and that's what he meant by virtual water. It's really the water bound up in international trade in I guess commodities of all sorts, though it's principally bound up in food trade. So big water guzzling crops like corn and rice and sugar and indeed wheat are traded around the world. Effectively, you're trading water. I mean, you're certainly trading water in the form of food on a scale far greater than any attempt has been made to trade in water itself. That's a very very stabilizing phenomenon. I'm pretty certain that there would have been water wars of a fairly major kind in the Middle East if countries didn't have the option of importing water in the form of food. They would have simply had to go to war to try and get water. So it's a stabilizing influence. But it's one of another aspect, I suppose, of the globalization of trade and commodities that we have this. And it does run the risk that countries that are quite short of water find themselves nonetheless exporting water, or at any rate virtual water, in the form of very thirsty crops. And there are a number of examples around the world of countries that that do that. An obvious example would be Pakistan, which is much of which is desert, but which exports large amounts of water in the form of cotton and sugar and other extremely thirsty crops. The result is that while the people growing those crops, the large landowners growing those crops, do very nicely out of that, it deprives water of other farmers, deprives other farmers of water, and leads to water riots and, you know, quite serious internal conflicts over access to water within the country. So at that point, I think trade in virtual water becomes a destabilizing influence, certainly within countries.
You give some really stunning examples of how many liters of water it takes to produce something like a T-shirt, or compared to a hamburger or a glass of milk.
Well, we're talking about tons of water produce a kilogram, or indeed just a hamburger, which is rather less than a kilogram. After all, that takes a simple hamburger takes about 11 tons of water to produce. A kilogram of rice takes around half that. A liter of milk, it takes something like 4 tons of water to produce. These are very unexpected, certainly to me, and I think to most people, very unexpectedly large amounts of water needed in order to either grow crops or grow the fodder to feed animals to produce things like meat and dairy products. If you add all these up, my own calculation was that in order to keep me fed and watered, if you like, for a single day, takes 100 times my own weight in water. That figure came as a huge and frankly total surprise to me. I had no idea that so much water was being used just to kind of keep me on the road. And it really does go a long way to explaining why parts of the world are running short of water. We have these huge trades in virtual water in the form of crops going around the world. As a result of the water taken out of rivers and taken out of rivers to grow these crops, great rivers of the world are in the title of my book, are literally running dry.
Yes, you have a line in the book where you say the maps and an atlas no longer accord with reality. Can you describe what's happening there?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I was at school, I was brought up with the sort of standard atlas and the standard sense of the rivers of the world, which started in the mountains and worked their way across the plains mines and emptied into the sea, but in many parts of the world it's not really like that anymore. They come out of the mountains, go onto the plains, and all the water is taken out of them, and there's nothing left in the riverbed for the last few hundred miles before they reach the sea. I mean, look, I'm talking about small rivers here. I mean, we're talking about some of the great rivers of the world. The River Nile, for instance, the longest river in the world, literally no water flows out of that into the Mediterranean Sea for most years. All that water is taken for irrigation projects along the river in Sudan and principally in Egypt. In China, virtually the whole of the water out of the Yellow River in northern China for most of the year is taken for irrigating crops. Similarly, the Indus in Pakistan, which I was referring to a moment ago, another river under very great stress. And in North America, in the U.S., the Colorado and the Rio Grande running along the border between the U.S. and Mexico. Again, these rivers, virtually no water reaches the sea. I stood on the banks of the Rio Grande, 300 miles from the Gulf of Mexico, and looked down into the riverbed, and it was empty. And, you know, it's empty for most of the year. So these are, if you like, huge and previously really rather undiscussed changes to the geography of the planet. We talk about the damage we're doing to the atmosphere through pollution and climate change and so on. We're doing certainly as great a damage to the rivers of the world by simply removing all their water. It has a whole range of consequences, some ecological, some social. Because clearly if the river is empty, if anybody downstairs, downstream has traditionally taken water from that river, they no longer can. And the risk is, partly within countries, that you get disputes over access to water, and there are many examples of that. But increasingly the risk is, of course, of international conflict, because if some country upstream is in a position to take all the water out of a river, the countries downstream that normally rely on that are inclined to get a little upset.
Mega projects and dams have been a kind of major feature that play into this sort of a major feature of 20th century water control. How do they fit into the picture?
Dams are the largest piece of engineering that pretty much the largest pieces of engineering that we do on the planet of any sort, really, but certainly on rivers. We literally can and do empty major rivers or capture all their water behind dams, and they give us total control over a river. But with that control come, I think, great dangers. If you could empty a river and divert all its water by collecting it in a reservoir and then sending it down canals or pipes to cities and farming systems, then you totally destroy the ecology downstream, and of course you damage people who want the water downstream. We're now moving on into the phase of not just single large dams, but whole complexes of dams and projects to move water not just within a river basin system, which is traditionally what dams do, but to move them from one river basin system to another system. The biggest project of that sort in the world is currently going on in China, where they are planning to spend $60 billion on moving water from the Yangtze River in the fairly wet south of the country, moving that water north in order to replenish the cities that used to rely on the Yellow River but no longer can because that river's run dry. Now, these are fantastic projects. India has been talking about a project which could cost $200 billion, $200 billion, to move water from the wet north of the country to the drier south and west. So these are vast projects which will involve dozens of large dams and huge canal systems in order to move the water around. My own gut feeling is that many of these won't get built because by the time you got the water to the destination, it would simply be too expensive. But it does show the extreme pressure that some countries now feel about water shortages.
One of the other trends that you described, which is a bit alarming to me, is the draining of underground aquifers, often to water desert cities. What's going on there?
Well, it's happening really all over the world. The trouble with underground water is that it's out of sight, is rather out of mind, in the sense that if a river runs dry, you can at least see that it's run dry. But if underground water reserves, and these are very large water reserves in some places, so they are worth tapping. But if you overpump those and the water table goes down and down and down, so you have to go to ever greater depths to get your water. It's kind of invisible, and certainly for policymakers, it can kind of go on and on and on, and nobody worries. But they need to. The most potent example, I guess, is in India now. Now, more than half of India's food, this is a country of 1 billion people, more than half the food to feed those people is grown now using underground water reserves. So farmers are just pumping up water from beneath their fields, and they're doing this because there's no water left in the rivers. Now that's fine, except that they are pumping far more water than goes back down during the monsoon rains to replace it. One calculation done by a reputable agricultural research institute in India reckons that, if you'll excuse the units, Indian farmers pump up 250 cubic kilometers of water from beneath the ground every year, and the monsoon rains only replace 150 cubic kilometers of water. In other words, the farmers are pumping up 100 cubic kilometers more water than the rains are replacing, and that's why a generation ago in many parts of India you could bring water to the surface basically by hand digging a well and sticking a bucket down it, and you bring the water up at 20 or 30 feet. But now you have to go down a half a mile or even further before you find water. And I've met farmers in India who are literally drilling further down every couple of months in order to carry on bringing water to the surface, in order to be able to carry on farming. And ultimately, they're not going to be able to do that, because ultimately these reserves will run dry. And as they run lower and lower, they tend to find the water is more and more contaminated as well, which is another risk. So this is a huge threat to India's continuing ability to feed itself. One calculation is at least a quarter of the food grown in India, in other words, the food to feed a quarter of 1 billion people, is grown using water that is not being replaced by the rains. And so ultimately that won't happen. Ultimately, India may not be able to feed itself unless it can transform the efficiency with which it uses its water.
You tell some very, I mean, these are very compelling stories, and in some ways, you know, extremely surprising, the scale of the crisis that we're facing with water. Why do you say that water will be the defining crisis of the 21st century?
Well, I think simply because it's so fundamental to our lives. People talk about oil as the politics of oil, but I think we can find substitutes for oil, and ultimately, as individuals, we don't need oil every day in order to get by. It's convenient, but we don't need it physically to live. But we do physically need water every day in order to keep us going, and that's before we start talking about the water needed to grow the food that we need to eat every day. So it's very fundamental, and we're starting to come up against limits. Another, I think, reason why it's going to be an issue is because the other overarching resource, I think, an environmental issue that's going to is hitting us in the 21st century is climate change, of course. And climate change, in my judgment, is going to be experienced by most people less through global warming, which will happen, but more pertinently through changes to where water is and availability of water, whether it's through floods sometimes, and it does look like increasing amounts of drought as well. So I think, if you like, put there are huge demands that we're making on the natural water cycle. You know, water is a renewable resource, but only up to a point. The huge demands that we're making on water, plus the disruption that's likely to be created to our once reliable water supply system through climate change, you put the two together, I think we have a very potent mixture. And my own feeling is that our massive use of water and the changes in climate are going to create a very considerable crisis in many parts of the world, perhaps less so in Canada than in many places, but of course none of us is insulated, because if the world food supply system is disrupted by a lack of water, then that's going to impact us all.
Your book outlines many of the water use conflicts based on the idea that rivers many times not only have competing users along its length, but also cross international borders. Do you think that there's some way of addressing that issue to make more fair use of water?
Well, I think we do need more international law on water. I mean, there isn't a global treaty on water. Some international rivers do have treaties attached to them. The Indus now has a treaty brokered by the World Bank, which basically said that it wouldn't fund dam projects on the river until there was an agreement between India and Pakistan, who are the competing claimants for that water. There are efforts to reach similar treaties on the River Nile, where currently Egypt, which is downstream, continues to take most of the water, but upstream countries like Ethiopia have increasing demands for water. So there are potential conflicts there. And major international rivers around the world, and many rivers are international, I think basically they all need treaties to ensure that the downstream people who clearly feel most vulnerable to water shortages can be assured that they will carry on getting water. But of course, in some places we've got rather beyond that. I mean, if you look in the Middle East, there are examples of where really there is, there desperately needs to be some sort of agreement, and there isn't. Perhaps the classic example is the River Jordan, which flows from what was Syria, but is currently under Israeli control on the Golan Heights, through what one might call Israel proper, and on into Jordan and the Dead Sea. Unfortunately, currently no water, or virtually no water, gets down the River Jordan into the country that bears its name, in other words, into the country Jordan, because most of it is taken by Israelis for their own purposes. So, there really does need to be an agreement about sharing of the water on that river. And my own judgment is that that would ease many of the tensions in that region, particularly perhaps between Israel and Syria, but certainly also between Israel and Jordan. So these are, I mean, almost as important as land in some arid parts of the world is, the politics of water is almost as important as the politics of land, and you don't get much more fundamental than that.
Fred, you describe yourself as an optimist where water is concerned. What directions do you think we need to head in to arrive at a more ecologically sound and a more secure water future?
I think we need to start thinking about water as or our water problems as more, if I can put it this way, demand-side problems rather than supply-side problems. The conventional view is that if we have a water shortage, we build another dam, or we do some engineering in order to deliver more water. Whereas increasingly, I think it does make much more sense to address our demands to find ways of recycling water from our urban sewage, recycling that so that can either be drunk again or used in agriculture or some other purpose, perhaps for industry, to use water more efficiently. I mean, most of our cities waste large amounts of water through leaks from water mains, and some of that water can be pumped up and used again, but some of it can't because it becomes polluted. So we need to think about plugging the leaks. We need to think about being more efficient in our homes and in our factories, and in many parts of the world in our agriculture as well, more efficient in our use of water. And there are huge gains to be made. I mean, that's why ultimately I am optimistic, is that if you like, we are so bad and so inefficient in the way that we use water now, that we could do things so much better. So there are things that we can do. We don't inevitably have to face water crises around the world. If we were rather more efficient, rather more thoughtful in the way that we used and shared water, we could solve many of these problems. I don't think that's technically difficult. I don't think it's even economically difficult. Perhaps the problem is getting the politics right.
And I had that conversation earlier this week with Fred Pierce, the author of When the Rivers Run Dry, Journeys into the Heart of the World's Water Crisis. And you're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.